Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Richard Skipper celebrates the best in entertainment. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique, never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Friday, everyone. Happy Independence Day. Happy whatever it is that you are celebrating. And this show is all about celebrating. For those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. As I said, my show is about celebrating, thus the title, Richard Skipper Celebrates. I celebrate artists and their body of worth. What makes a great artist? How do they get from point A to point B and beyond? I want to hear about their journey, how they got to where they are today. And I appreciate the fact that you're all here for this journey today as I celebrate Sandra Bergman. And I am so excited that she said yes to being here. I took the last week off so that I could revamp, brand re everything, and we're starting off July in great style. She's a great actress. She's a great singer. She's an inner spiritual minister, which I want to talk about. And I want to tell you a little bit before we begin to talk about how some of these shows come together. Sandra and I actually met a few years ago when she came. I think you came to one of the Richard Skipper Celebrates live events that we did.
I did.
With our mutual friend, Ann Kittredge. And a few weeks ago, I came out of COVID, my first outdoor, just incredible barbecue. And Sandra was there. And a couple of days later, Ann called me up and said, Richard, have you thought about interviewing Sandra Bergman? She's really interesting. And I said, I am so glad you said that because I agree. And I want to thank you for being here. I want to begin by asking you, since I'm all about celebrating, what are you celebrating today?
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me on. I'm celebrating that.
Thank you. And
I, you know, it's funny. I've been thinking about freedom, the word freedom. I always light a candle before I do anything like this. And I pulled out this beautiful butterfly candle and it says freedom. At the top, freedom. I didn't even know that when I lit it. So I'm celebrating my ever ongoing growth in understanding what really freedom is for our democracy, for myself personally. And I'm having friends coming up and I'm celebrating the opening of my new venue on my property in the Catskills.
Tell everybody about this new venue. I love the fact that you're opening this up and I hope... If I'm not crossing any lines, then I'm going to be invited
up. Come on up. You are completely invited up. Everyone's invited up. Plenty of room. Well, so my husband and I bought a home. We had a home for many years, for 17 years in the Catskills. And we also are in Manhattan. And we just, right before COVID, we sold that house. We'd been wanting to sell it because our experience of the land was a little bit not to our liking. We had some neighbors around us that were handling their yards in ways that we didn't want to. And then this house around the corner came available at the end of 2019. So literally, we moved around the corner. And what attracted me to this house was that it had this enormous garage on it, enormous and separate from the house. And I've always had in the back of my mind, I wanted to have a little community space, a little performance space. You can do cabaret, you can have house concerts, you know, meetings, just build community and poetry readings, you name it. And because I'm an interfaith minister and I also do weddings, I can have elopements and things like that. So this place is fantastic. It can literally fit. And I own them now, 50 fold-out chairs. And so we can have a number of people and it can spill out onto the lawn. And I got two chandeliers, the real deal crystal chandeliers from friends of mine that I've done from the theater that they run. And they're in the center of it. We've painted it purple, gorgeous plum purple. We're calling it the Plum Garage. So it's really marvelous to have it. It's just been a great joy and just a place to, you know, and the good news, I don't have to make this business, make money with this business. Mm-hmm. I can really genuinely use it for fun and certainly for work. I'm going to see clients there, but really the goal is for fun.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, we, you know, no surprise to anyone watching the show today. We've just been a year and a half plus going through this thing called COVID. Mm-hmm. We're not out of the woods yet, folks.
No.
Still working on this. I want to ask you, how did the past year impact you the most beyond the normal things that we've all gone through, quote unquote, whatever normal means?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that I'm sure that I can speak for a lot of people that it was a lot of sadness over things that were taken away, but of a lot of silver linings that were very unexpected. You know, I'm an extroverted introvert. I'm okay mm-hmm. being by myself, but I'm not okay not collaborating and not creating. So while when we first went into it, I felt very adrift and got depressed and did, you know, the lovely stress eating that we've all been talking about. But as COVID went on and I adjusted, and I also lost my father, which in April of COVID, and that's oddly began to snap me out of my sadness. Interestingly, it made me, the grief of that sort of propelled me to, okay, you've really got to transform this, not push it aside, but really use it to birth something new. And basically, you know, that's what everyone's been going through. What is it that I need to use this time to rebirth? Because we don't know what's on the other side. Everyone talks about, well, when things get back to normal, and what is that? What is back to normal? So the new house, the new venue made me happy. I gave me something to do as I mourned the loss of other things. I did a lot of Zoom weddings, which was surprising. And the time on Zoom was shockingly intimate and lovely, which was not something I expected. Mm-hmm. And I started writing a lot more, which is a newly discovered love that I contributed a chapter to a friend's book, and I'm writing a play. So it, in a nutshell, what I needed to do was just reemerge with some new ways of thinking about how my creative life might be, and combined with where I am in my, you know, how old I am, what the rest of my life, you know, this is a big shifting time. So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just had to embrace it. I just had to.
Well, let's go back a little bit. If I'm not mistaken, you're originally from Pittsburgh. Is that correct?
I am. My God.
What was that?
I said, "Hey, my God, that's Pittsburghese." Hey, my God, how you doing down there?
So I, you know, for those who have seen my other shows, I'm going to ask a question that I ask a lot. I want to go back to the 5-year-old Sandra. Is this your full original name?
It is.
Okay. So when you were 5-year-old Sandra Bergman, growing up in Pittsburgh, to me, that is that pivotal moment in a person's life before they start school and the peer pressure of not only school friends and popular kids, unpopular kids, but also the teachers. Who tried to shape you into what you should or should not be on this path. So what was your life like as a 5-year-old growing up in Pittsburgh?
Well, I didn't move to Pittsburgh until I was 10. My parents are originally from Pittsburgh. I was born in Syracuse.
Whoa, okay.
And but I, for all intents and purposes, I consider that I grew up in Pittsburgh. They moved us back for a variety of reasons back to Pittsburgh when I, just before my 10th birthday. Mm-hmm. And but if I think about the five-year-old me and how I was influenced by the teachers. You know, I was pretty lucky. I had, both in Syracuse and in Pittsburgh, I had teachers that, and particularly in Pittsburgh, by the time I got to Pittsburgh, this is really true, but I had teachers that really supported, for the most part, supported, I was very shy, but very outgoing on stage, and they supported that in me. I mean, I remember one teacher that was kind of mean and cruel, and because I was tall and asked a lot of questions when I was, you know, I just really wanted to understand. I'm a curious human, very curious. Mm-hmm. And she put me down, but I fortunately, through teachers in my home life, particularly my mom, I was very uplifted. I only had a small pushback on, you know, from a couple of teachers and from my dad, a little pushback to be, you know, the quintessential, you're too much, you're too loud, you're too this. And so.
And which of those did you embrace?
Oh, yes. Which of those did I embrace? I embraced my curiosity, of course. I embraced, and like I said, I was an extroverted introvert. I was really fine being by myself and going off on my own. And I embraced my performing, you know, and I was the kid, and this is maybe a great seg. I was the kid that had the antenna. I was the one who could read the energy in the room. And I knew who to stay away from. And I knew, you know, basically. And I could read, kind of feel and read the empathic read of the room. Mm-hmm. And my spiritual life and my connection to the veil, if you will, was always very prevalent from my very first memories. Mm-hmm. So if there was anything I was going to embrace, it was going to be my performing in my garage, like with my little tambourine that my parents brought back from Puerto Rico, and my sense of nature and being out in nature, and definitely being out in nature and my sense of spirit.
Now, did you grow up in a spiritual or religious household?
I didn't. My parents were, you know, typical, go to church on holidays. And, you know, my mother, I have no recollection of this, but my mother told me that she took me to Bible school when I was little. I have no recollection of it. But, you know, we went to church. I was always very attracted to going to church. I loved going to church. It wasn't like I had a thing against it. I loved all the iconography. I loved the ritual. I loved the music. I loved the costuming. And my parents never jammed it, never were heavy-handed with it. And, you know, and as I blossomed into wanting to be an interfaith minister, my mother was more curious and more wanted to know what I had learned. She looked to me to teach her, which was glorious.
Well, before we talk about the acting path that you went down, when you decided, or maybe it was decided for you, that you were going to become an interspiritual minister, what was the response that you got from those closest to you?
Well, most everyone was like, of course. Of course. Mm-hmm. There was genuinely no shock because I have never been hidden with my curiosity, my spiritual quest, my reading of things, my sharing of things, my taking of classes, my reaching out. I've never been private about that. And I've been, I wouldn't say vocal, but just certainly transparent. And in particularly my mom, she was thrilled. And interestingly enough, the timing of me saying that I wanted to be a minister, I And this was a while coming. I had had some seeds planted along the way about life coaching and starting that, not really digging it, and then moving into wanting to go to seminary. And right as the summer before I went into seminary, my parents were celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary. And we decided to throw them a big 3-day party up here in the Catskills and invite everybody in. And at the time, my mother was dying of cancer.
I'm sorry.
And thank you. And she asked me to be the minister at her funeral. Mm. And I had been with her going through this as it deepened and, you know, the more information was given and the diagnosis was kept changing and getting worse and worse. And then by the time the 50th hit, it was almost like she had this, like, I did what I needed to do. I can go. And I'm asking you to be my minister. So during my first year of seminary, I wrote her ceremony with her and her obituary. And it was the most painful and the most glorious gift I could have asked for.
It's interesting. I mean, before we went live, you said to me today, I love the orange. And I said, I'm wearing orange. This is an orange day. And orange is for healing. And I'm thinking of the families in Miami right now, and what they're going through. I can't even imagine. I'm going to tear up thinking about this. I can't imagine the pain that they're going through. But to me, the greatest gift in the world is being able to, quote unquote, check out feeling that you've done what you were brought here to do. And that's a gift that your mom gave you and that you gave her. Getting back to the artistic side of your life, we're going to go back and forth with this. But when you were growing up in both Syracuse and Pittsburgh, did you grow up in a household that was surrounded by the arts? Did you have a hi-fi? Were you a television household? Yes.
Totally. My parents would have parties and like bring in, you know, Tom Jones wannabes. Oh, totally. It was like they were the hipsters, you know, and it was in suburbia in Syracuse. And, you know, it was like Mad Men. It was that scene. And my father played the violin, which I took up, and in fact, played his violin till the time I went to college and loved it. My mom played the piano and sang. I think probably, you know, she lived a little vicariously through me that way. But she had a great voice. And, you know, I grew up with Dionne Warwick and Herb Alpert and Burt Bacharach. And we had the songbooks and the upright piano with the flower powers pasted on. And I would do these little backyard cabarets with Herb on the piano. And I would walk around the neighborhood and give out tickets for 5 cents and stage this beautiful with all the neighborhood kids, stage a little fashion show in between, have costume changes. It was, yeah, they were very supportive.
And how did the theater find you, or how did you find the theater?
Well, I was just always doing plays. And thankfully, you know, my parents got me into it. You know, I've been singing since and being in plays. I was in my first play at 6 years old. And I oddly felt more at home on the stage than I did in real life. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a sense of a heightened sense of this is the truth versus, which is interesting. Yeah, I was always doing that. And so when we moved, when the time came and all of the variables came together for us to move to Pittsburgh, my parents were marvelous in that they looked around in all of the counties, where's the best place that has the best music and the best drama. And they got us a home in Forest Hills in Pittsburgh. And it was a remarkable musical program in the elementary all the way through. I mean, I played Catashaw in the Mikado in middle school. You know, it just was really remarkable.
Well, it's one thing to have this exposure, to even do it in school. It's a completely different ball of wax when you say, I'm going to pursue this as a career. When, where, and how did that happen for you?
It was in high school. Interestingly enough, which is so true to form, that I have so many interests, which is why I have 100 things on my poster. I played basketball and was contemplating, it was getting, and you know, you can't be 6 foot tall and not have somebody give you a basketball.
That was running through my head.
Yeah, not that I was really that great, but you know, I mean, I was taller and graceful. I was a dancer. I was kind of graceful, but not that great. But back then, you know, I was getting scouted to play in college and on a scholarship because there weren't at that time, you know, these amazing women. It was just starting, you know, and so I was kind of on the edges of doing that. But I wasn't this burning as a little kid, like, I'm going to be a star. That wasn't me. I had a lot of interests and liked going on a lot of different paths. But finally, in my junior year, I had to make a decision. I said, you know what? I can't imagine not doing this professionally. I can't imagine not doing this professionally. So, boom, I'm going to let everything else go, all of the other activities, and focus fully on this. And then look into college, into conservatory training, which is exactly what I did.
And how long was it before you made the move to New York after that? Did you continue doing community theater? Did you stay in Pittsburgh after college? How did the move to New York happen for you?
I stayed in Pittsburgh for that summer because we did a couple of the not just the graduates, but former students, all Carnegie graduates, all went to, we went to a place called Hartwood Acres. And we did two shows in rep. We did Candide, which Mel Shapiro directed, who was then the director of our program. And Arnie Zasloff did a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which Anne Kittredge was in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she played Titania and I played the tall one.
Is that where you originally met?
No, we had known each other in school. Okay. This was after I graduated. She still had another year. But so we did that in rep. And then that fall, I moved to New York. And that was, and went back to, and then moved into Brooklyn with a dear friend of mine whom I had done, I played Louisa in Fantastics with, my one and only time as an ingenue. And he had played Matt. And when I was 18, I got one shot at being an ingenue. And I moved in with him. And then we moved to Manhattan.
Well, do you mind if I ask what year that was that you moved to New York?
It was 1984.
Okay, shortly. I came in 1979. A very different New York than what it is right now.
Very, very different. Baby.
Had you been to New York prior to that? Had you been to see shows?
I love this.
What was the first Broadway show that you saw? And what was the impact that it had on you?
The first Broadway show I saw was The King and I with Yul Brynner. It was glorious. I was 16 and my parents were gifted by one of their colleagues, a client they worked with, gifted us a penthouse apartment on the east side with a glass floor to ceiling. And we were like, we didn't know what hit us. And we, all four of us, they got us fourth row seats to The King and I. I mean, you know, Yul Brynner spitting on us. It was extraordinary. And I, you know, on the one hand, it was mind-blowing. And on the other hand, it was like, oh, I'm going to live here. I'm totally going to live here. Mm-hmm. No problem. And
now, when you came to New York and you've made the move, you're living, first of all, in Brooklyn and then Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Was New York what you had envisioned it? And if so, I mean, what were the things about New York that were exactly as you had envisioned it in your mind? And what were some of the biggest surprises for you?
Oh, I love this. Well, I went to Carnegie Mellon. So, you know, I had been, you know, prepared for strife and trauma, and come out of it successfully. And but they also, we, you know, had the league audition. So I was armed with, out of the gate, I was armed with an agent. So that was a great help. So I, which is not to say that every audition that I got was through them. What I expected was the competition. I mean, that I'd already dealt with it and had no, this was not shocking at all. I had no misgivings or upset about that. I think what was shocking to me was that I came from, you know, and it just stands to reason, I was able to do a lot of straight plays. I was able to do musicals. I was able to share a little bit more spectrum of interests and likes and loves and explore characters that way. And when I got to New York, I got pinned into a showgirl musical track that at the time I didn't really buck it because I didn't really get that it was so narrow for me. Mm-hmm. But as time went on, that became really difficult. And I at the time was also not a great networker. Because I kind of move organically. So it's, I'm great with follow-ups and I'm great with thank yous and I'm great with a lot of things. But at the time I was not a great aggressive networker. I had to feel a little more organic with it. So the requirements of that was, at least to my mind, was a challenge.
Now, and this may sound like an unusual question, but I'm sure that you're going to figure it out for me. But coming to New York with an agent that early in your career, was that a blessing or a curse for you at the time?
No, I totally get why you're asking that. And no, it was not a curse. I got cast in out of the gate. I got cast. They were trying to do a Broadway revival of Bubble and Brown Sugar, directed once again by the wonderful Billy Wilson. And we were to have raised money. We ended up going to Walnut Street Theater, and we were to raise money to return to Broadway with some of the original cast members and some new cast members, which would have included me. And I got my equity card doing that. I was in New York maybe a year, maybe 9 months. Mm-hmm. But it was not getting my equity card that was the thing that would have stood in my way. And I knew Billy Wilson from Carnegie too, actually. Mm-hmm. It was not that, it was my height. That was the challenge always for me, because I'm a good dancer, but I'm not like Broadway girl. Like I can't walk in and go flap. I've played Lola, but I was given the opportunity to rehearse and get things, you know, and I'm quite graceful and move really well, but you know, upstate, I would call myself a dancer. New York City, I would say actor who moves well. You know, so that was, and so the tall girls were the ones who were the really tall ones like me were the ones that were getting the dance roles. They also danced really hardcore. I remember my agent one time telling me, and it was like the third time, she goes, well, we've heard from the casting and they said, you're just too tall. And I'm like, okay, I won't wear any heels anymore. Which of course was not true, but you know, I mean, I knew that was going to happen. You know, it's not like I was shocked by that.
Right, right, right. Well, how do you convince them otherwise? Did you get to a point where you were able to do that?
To convince them to go in that direction?
Yes.
Well, I think at some point, you know, some of the people I auditioned for were charmed by it. Mm-hmm. You know, and could have some vision about, oh, it would be fine for her to be this tall or taller than that. You know, for instance, Adelaide and Guys and Dolls, which Billy Wilson directed me, my senior, and Anne Kittredge played Sarah. Mm-hmm. But we did my senior year of college and Billy Wilson directed it. That's how I knew him. But, you know, that was people who were happy to see that could see casting a little fun and a little different were fine to do that. I went on and did Adelaide a number of times with people, but I also was able to do other things. And I also got, you know, people, they ended up for whatever reason wanting me and were willing to cast someone tall enough to be opposite me. So,
I heard an interview, and this person is on the complete opposite of the spectrum from you. She's a little person. Mm-hmm. And she said, when I walk into an audition, the first thing they think of is Wizard of Oz, Elf, the Christmas show at Radio City Music Hall, you know, any show where they're going to be looking for little people. And mm-hmm. she says, and yet they don't realize that I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a grandmother, I'm all these things. And when I think of theater, I think of theater as being a reflection of life. And I'm hoping that in our lifetimes that we will see, and we're finding this more and more with diversity casting and everything, yes, that people can think outside the box. We talked about this briefly when we were at Anne's last month. Mm-hmm. Or a month before last, I should say. I can't believe it was a month before last. Because we were talking about Halston and mm-hmm. the fact that Ian McGregor is a straight actor playing a gay man. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who were upset about the fact that he wasn't gay. I, on one hand, say, you know, may the best person get the job. But on the other side, I get where people are coming from with that.
Totally. So
I want to be open to both sides of the spectrum. You mentioned getting your equity card early on. Was that a holy grail item for you?
Oh, of course, I think so. I can't imagine that it wasn't. I don't think it's changed at all. Yeah, I'm sure it was. That I was just going to get paid the kind of money that I wanted. The best that I could do potentially. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, before I knew about all the other ways, but mm-hmm. you can get around that. Yeah, I think that there's a sense of, at least for me, there was a sense of accomplishment and that I was working with Broadway people, bang, mm-hmm. and that I was a card carrying member now too.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned a few moments ago that you were really good on the back end of the follow-up, but the networking part was difficult for you. Looking back over this early, the Hunger years, as I like to refer to them, the beginning, yeah. Were you ambitious? In terms of the pursuit of your career, or were you, and you know, not taking away from the talent that's obviously there, or was it a matter of being at the right place at the right time and knowing the right people? Looking back, how do you feel that you actually mapped out the career that you have?
Oh, wow. Well, I would have to say it's a little of everything. I was certainly ambitious, absolutely ambitious. I mean, and you're actually, it's ambition is cultivated mm-hmm. in a conservatory. I probably wasn't even that ambitious given the story that I told about, it took me to my, you know, basically my senior year in high school to commit to going to conservatory. But I, you know, once I did, I was ambitious. And it's not that I didn't, go after, people and things that I wanted and send pictures out and go to this and do that and not necessarily wait for my agent to do things. But I wasn't somebody who went to parties and did that and talked to this one and blah, 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 and built those kinds of relationships that I can see were important, but I was a bit too shy to do at the time. Or it didn't feel organic, it felt a little forced. I think there's also, there was a timing issue. There was often a timing issue, you know, and I think, Yeah, I had some things taken away from me, some really nice things that were given to me that could have helped me greatly that were taken away. You know, for reasons that I can only, that the powers that be, the other people on the powers that be line decided that they wanted their person to have it rather than, and, but you know, if I go down that, if I go down that path, you know, I've done a lot of work to not be saddened, by some of those losses because, and other things came into my life and truth be known, I do have other paths that also make me happy, that I've been able to weave through. And I've made choices, you know, at a time when I was feeling kind of angry about New York City, I chose to move upstate for a brief period of time with my then boyfriend, now husband, onto a 3,000 acre nature preserve in the middle of nowhere with a little cabin.
And bears.
And bears. Well, not this one, but yeah, bears. And like, and a composting toilet that I named the throne. And to live, you know, and I told my husband, my then boyfriend, I said, listen, you know, I'd let my apartment go in New York City. My friends were becoming celebrities and sitcom stars in Hollywood. And so I said, I'd gotten off a cruise gig and I'm going out to California and I'm going to see what's out there for me. And I, you know, my friends set me up with blah, 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 and all kinds of interviews and things. And within 10 seconds, I knew that it wasn't the town for me. At least, again, as you mentioned, the timing. And so I moved back, but I didn't have my New York apartment. And I told my husband, I said, listen, okay, I'll move in with you upstate. And I'll move into this little cabin with a composting toilet. And you know, I will see what regional theater is available. I'll just see what's available to me in that area. And will, and when I'm pulling my hair out and need to go back to New York City, we'll cross that bridge together. And so I moved, and within 4 days, I had a beautiful job, the equity contract at an outdoor theater that I ended up working in 3 of the 4 years that I lived there before I did indeed go back to New York. I did a four years of A Christmas Carol with John Astin while I was there, which was a gift of my life. He was, oh my God, a slice of heaven.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, he was, everyone in the cast, every man, woman, and child was in love with him. And I lived on a nature preserve and the literally no lights at night. And so this element of, I mean, you can just imagine this big hair, big earrings, big high heels comes walking into this nature preserve where they're doing biological research. Everyone that lives on this preserve is doing scientific research. And then I show up. And it was a slice of heaven for me. I really connected to that nature-loving quieting stillness. And I think that's where I was able to really reconnect with and let go of some of the ambition and some of the anger towards this ongoing push with a theatrical career or an artistic career in that track. And I could really, I could allow that other portion of my heart to expand. And it was really exciting. And then 3.5 years later, I was pulling my hair out.
Well, I want to talk about three different areas of this business in terms of how you respond to it. And the first area is success. When you look at your life and career, what was the one moment where you felt, above all else, I'm a success at what I do?
When I was standing on the stage at the Kennedy Center and doing exotic bird calls, and the entire audience, the show stopped and they started to clap. The entire audience clapped. I'm kidding. That's really not it, but it was what just popped to mind. it was a moment. It was a moment. I stopped an audience at the Kennedy Center. It was a moment.
That's right. That's
right. Doing an exotic bird call, which, by the way, is on my special skills list.
What's the most exotic bird call that you do?
Oh my God. Well, that's really not a bird. It's kind of halfway a bird and half a monkey, like a rabid monkey. It definitely
is. You want to share it with us?
We're going to blow out the system. Oh my God. It is.
We'll do that privately.
Oh my God. Yes, indeed. Over lots of wine. Actually, it doesn't take a lot of wine for me.
I want to go to the other end of the spectrum. And that is dealing with failure. And sometimes I have a friend, and it's one of my favorite expressions. He says, rejection is God's protection. Mm-hmm. And I have an accountability group that we meet with quite often. And we just met yesterday, and we were venting about the things that get to us and in this business and the things that we don't think are fair and getting through all of that and everything. But I want to ask you, without naming any names or a specific situation that will give it away, because I'm all about celebrating. Okay. What was the lowest point for you in this business, and how did you manage to get through it?
Well, I think probably the lowest point for me was... it was after seminary. I've always kept my performing life going, even when I went to seminary and was still auditioning and doing performances. And after I was ordained and my mother passed away, and that absolutely sent me to the abyss. And I wanted nothing to do with the business. I was like, I just needed to focus on the depth of sadness that I had, and that I had this new the grief. I mean, keep in mind, the grief was also a part of me being able to immerse into this 2-year program. That is so know thyself, like an actor's journey, a spiritual journey of know thyself. So I was really able to immerse. And as I was coming out, while I was in seminary, I had this idea for starting my own company, Sacred Stages. And in my mind, it was birthed out of, you know, I love studying all these world traditions. I love going to the mosque. I love going to the cathedral. I love the chapel. I love all of these explorations. But for me, who is not affiliated with any organized religion, where do I go? Nature, of course, but where do I go to be with community? And the first thing that popped to mind was the theater, the stage. The stage, as I got this visual of an altar. And so I got the idea for Sacred Stages. And then I immediately started to work as a spiritual counselor. I went to another seminary for 2 years, and I became a dean of first-year students. I was asked to become a dean of first-year students at the seminary through which I was ordained. And then I became the spiritual counselor at a wellness center in the bar building. In Manhattan. A friend of mine owned this business, and she hired me to be the resident spiritual counselor. And I had a lovely time doing that, you know, and I did some voiceover work, and I did, a little this, little that there. But I was really immersed in that and having a great time and exploring that world. But then I started really, like, what am I doing with Sacred Stages? This thing that was birthed in me, and it started to grow. And I started to get really angry at myself. That, you know, that's kind of my go-to, is anger when things are not right. I don't get really set, we know that anger is a mask for sadness, but mine is displayed as anger. And then I started to get really angry that, you know, I felt like I had this life that I had to manage. And I started to get this idea for The Edge of Every Day, the show that I created, which was based on that low point of I love this life that I've created, but I am not the independent creative force that I want to be, that I was, that I want to be again. And so this dual edge of wanting that loving life and wanting that creative independence where I could go out and create my own show and do this again and it really rose in me. And that was the impulse to create mm-hmm. The Edge of Every Day.
That's wonderful. And the next area is passion. Mm-hmm. So is your passion as strong as, stronger, or a little less strong as it was when you first started in this business? And I'm talking about the business aspect of it.
Okay. Not the totality of what I do, just the theatrical.
The totality in a moment. I'm talking about the business itself.
Oh, I'm nowhere near as ambitious. I mean, I would certainly say I'm not ambitious. I'm writing a play that I expect to do somewhere big. But no, I'm not ambitious in the same way. I don't have that same drive to go back in and, I'll self-tape. I'll do that occasionally, but it's just not something I've happily been able to have people that I've worked with in the past offer me things. And so that's been lovely, but that's not a ambitious track, mm-hmm. So.
Well, let me talk about the totality of it. From an outsider looking at your life, it seems heavenly. That you've created this wonderful world for yourself, bridging what I love, the world of theater and faith and spirituality together. Mm. To me, that's the ultimate goal in this business.
Heaven. Thank you.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, the fact that I'm a very spiritual person myself, and I look at, I'll tell you a very quick, interesting story. Years ago, when I was performing as Carol Channing, she came to see one of the shows, and I was on stage talking about the first time you're on stage. And from her perspective, and I said, I was standing on stage and I knew I was standing on holy ground. And she yells from the audience, "It's hallowed ground."
Yes.
And of course, it took me, immediately into the moment that there I am performing on stage as Carol Channing, talking about that importance of standing on stage. All of our artist friends that are here, you've all experienced it. You know what it's like to be on that stage. And to me, it is a spiritual space to be. And I think that for me, once I began to connect the two, it became a lot easier for me.
Oh, truly. Truly. And that's at the heart of absolutely at the heart of sacred stages. And it's not by accident mm-hmm. that the ancient roots of theater and spirituality are one and the same. And the Greek maxim in the theater of Greece, the Greek maxim, mm-hmm. know thyself, which is at the heart of the creative life, the creative journey, the spiritual journey, the leadership journey. Know thyself. It's one and the same.
So. I want to ask you, this may sound, I don't think any of these questions sound unusual to you, but
love that.
And I say that with the highest praise for you. But when you look back over your life to this moment, how much do you feel that the life that you've led to this moment has impacted you? And how much do you feel that you've impacted the life that you've led up to this point?
I think the life that I've led has impacted me. Well, certainly my sense of I am certain that I am more at ease in the world. Having the three paths come together and the willingness to look internally and the strength to look internally and to be amongst, once I moved to the preserve, my whole childhood was spent in nature And then I returned to it when I moved to the preserve. And it never, I never not had a life, a presence in nature from that point on, even though I went back to New York. Mm-hmm. So this life that I've created has impacted me in a way that has allowed me, has served me in all of the path that, because I'm not somebody that necessarily, and I've learned this about myself, and I remember saying to you that you, in our quick little conversation, that I walk on the edges of a lot of communities. Mm-hmm. And the life that I've carved out has allowed me to do that. And I like that a lot.
That's great. Now, I have some questions here that I'm going to ask as we begin to wind down today. And these are questions that are generic questions that I have pulled from my readings and everything. And the question that, the first question that I'd like to ask you is, who is the one person that has touched you the most? And I don't mean physically, folks, that has touched you on a spiritual level in your life?
That would have to be Gloria Karpinski. Was a glorious mentor of mine. I met her at seminary. She is like a mother figure. And I don't have a lot of mentors. I have people that have taught, but not somebody that I personally consider a mentor. And she's it. And I met her after my first year of seminary. She came and spoke to the graduates. I ended up producing and recording one of her books. What was the name of it? Oh my God. I've totally forgotten the name. The mind is a terrible thing to waste. But I recorded and produced one of her books on tape that we had done in seminary. Barefoot on Holy Ground.
Okay. And there it is. See, it's right there. Who is the person that you know who you most would like to spend a week with on a deserted island?
Who? Jesus Christ.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah, I'd really like to get the skinny on, you know, this is all like insanely insane what you've done.
And what is the best quality that you inherited from both of your parents?
I think from my father, my fairness, my openness, I think from my mother, my curiosity, my extraordinary curiosity, my passion, and probably from her, a little of her melancholy.
Wow. What has truly been the most embarrassing moment in your life?
Oh my God, where do I begin? embarrassing, most embarrassing. Well, this is so not the most embarrassing. I rest assured, but it's the first one that popped to my mind, so I'm going with it. I was doing Mamma Mia at Surflight Theater playing Donna, and we had these fabulous, as you know, those boots at the end. We come out in, and you know, we're all doing the final curtain call, which goes on forever, and it was so much fun. And I fell one night. I got so into it, so into the old disco, and just went whoop, crash, like center stage, like a whale. And I couldn't get, because the shoes were so high, I couldn't get back up. I
was is like, there a video
footage? Like a giraffe. Oh my God, it was hilarious.
Who is the person that you most would like to get into their mind?
Hmm. Wow. I would probably, interestingly, the only person, I'm trying to think of someone other than my mother, but my mother is the one that I, and probably because I am fascinated by the fact of, I would love to have taught, really gotten to the crux of why it was that she, you know, something beyond the obvious of, you know, we just didn't, you know, good girls went to teaching, went off to teach, and why she didn't have the courage or the strength or the whatever, which is not to say she didn't have a happy life and was not, didn't love my father and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I'd love to really, with her, pull that apart.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Who is the friend that you most often disagree with?
Who's a contrarian? My husband, which is so not true, but you know, I mean, you know, he and I are great. We are
great man.
Very opinionated. Oh, thanks. Yes. He loved meeting you. He's not a contrarian, and we more often than not agree, but we're unafraid to disagree. Let's put it that way.
I love that. What is your greatest virtue?
I'm brave.
And what is your best vice?
Comedy. Snarky comedy.
Snarky comedy. Well, Sandra, I love you even more so. I hope you had a great time being here.
I had a blast. Thank you so much for having me
here for a moment. I want to thank everybody for being here. I know that I can speak for Sandra when I say this. You could have been anywhere for the last hour. And the fact that you choose to spend an hour with me or my guest, it's not something that I take lightly. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. If you are here for the first time, I hope that you will subscribe to Richard Skipper Celebrates, because as I said at the top of the show, I'm all about celebrating artists, and we have some great artists coming up this month. I'm very excited with the people who have said yes, and a few people that are maybes for the months after that. So please subscribe, stick with us. If you enjoyed today's show, please hit the like button, leave a comment, and I hope that you will also check out some of the other videos that we have on the show, and also do the same with those, because it helps with analytics. And in the world of what we're doing virtually, it's all about the analytics. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Go to your Facebook friends list, and the second name that pops up, reach out with a phone call. Not an email, not a text message, not a private inbox message, but a phone call. And let that person know what they mean to you. Because as our dear friend David Friedman always says, he's a future guest, by the way, folks, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. And you never know what someone else is going through right now. And I always say, if you're going to be out on a boat, make sure that you bring a skipper along. Now, ending today's show, I am actually going to leave the screen, and I'm going to give you the final word, Sandra. Anything that you want to talk about or speak about that we talked about today that you want to expound upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message that you want to put out to everyone who's watching now. And again, I thank you for your body of worth, the gifts that you've given to the world, and the gifts that you will continue to give. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, all that I say is visit me at www.sandrabargeman.com if you want to see what I'm up to in the future. I will be posting about my upcoming venue and anything that's happening with plays or shows or things like that. So certainly. And we will be dusting off The Edge of Every Day and updating that, and are bringing that back to New York City. So keep your eyes peeled for that. And it's just been great to spend an hour with you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.